You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this Monday afternoon. You know, reading the newspaper this weekend was a lesson in outrage and heartbreak and really the consequences of breakdown in communication from the massacres of scores of Norwegians on Friday by Anders Behring Breivik, who called his own rampage atrocious but necessary, to the failure of discourse in our own government to bridge a widening political divide that threatens the stability of our country. But there were also hopeful signs of when communication can happen, such as the joyous faces of gay partners as they married on the first day that such marriages became legal in New York State. And that happened because people who disagreed with each other were able to work through their differences for the common good. How do we find new ways to speak to and listen to each other, even while holding passionate disagreement? This summer, the public radio program On Being is offering a 6-part series in which they explore the ways that Americans are attempting to connect across the bitterest and most divisive issues of our time. And I'm pleased that this series brings On Being host Krista Tippett back to The Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome, Krista.
Thanks, Julie. It's great to be with you again.
And you are in your studio in Minnesota, and we're in our studio here. So this is one way that communication can happen across a great geographical divide.
Yeah, it's a good side, the upside of technology.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, when you looked at the news of this weekend, did you think about ways that these kind of deep divides, whether it's what's happening in Norway with this ideological push against, it sounds like against Islam, although the victims were Norwegians, or this great divide in our own government. What did you think when you looked at all these stories?
Well, you're right. I really appreciate the way you framed this. And when you pull out these terrible events, I mean, you're right. You can read the newspaper on one day and it just feels hopeless. and I guess what is important to me is I don't think most of us want to live that way. Mm-hmm. Even when we find ourselves on this side or that side of some of these really divisive issues, right? It feels like our political system is in this deadlock, and it may not get out of it anytime soon. And yet I'm aware of a real longing for people as citizens to find ways to move forward in other kinds of civic spaces, that we can't just let this be the last word about how we live with disagreement and division in the early 21st century. And that's, you know, that's what has inspired us to delve into this.
And so when you looked for people to interview, and I know some of these interviews, perhaps all of them have been broadcast because I heard some of them and they were quite powerful. What were you looking for to try to spark a new way of having these kinds of conversations about things that we do have such deep disagreements about?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, we've turned it into a series, but you're right. The conversations aired before, and we started putting them on the air in response to these moments that felt like crisis. And then, as we've all experienced it, it feels like there's a crisis in our kind of civic life is now the norm. So the first show, this will not be the first show in the series, but the first time we played with this was back during the election of 2010. Elections have become predictably very fraught times now. I think
and they seem to last
for
all year.
That's
every
right.
Year.
They don't end. They yes. don't end. We're yeah. still in it. And we're, I think that what I'm looking, I think the question that sounds kind of obvious, but that we don't actually ask ourselves enough is, how can we find ways to be in conversation, to treat each other, to see each other as human beings, to treat each other with dignity, to maintain our own dignity, while acknowledging that we may continue to hold passionate disagreements on some really important issues and that those disagreements aren't going to be solved anytime soon. I think we have a reflex as Americans that if we can just take a vote, that if we can get that what we want to do is get on the same page. And in lieu of that, we're going to take a vote and there will be winners and losers and move on. But a lot of the big questions before us right now are civilizational and intimate and existential in nature. And, you know, we are going to be living with some of these open questions about how do we structure our public life? What is a marriage? What is a family? What is the nature of authority? What is truth? We're going to be living into new answers to these questions moving forward. So we were looking for people who have some real wisdom, who may be uncomfortable, and yet uncomfortable in a tone and with an approach that allows people who may disagree with them to listen in, to learn something, to feel calmed, and also to have some practical tools.
I'm speaking with Krista Tippett, who's the host of On Being, about the upcoming six-part series, Civil Conversations, which starts this weekend on WNYC. And you can listen to On Being on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. on 93.9 FM and on AM 820 at 3 p.m. Now, Krista, you talk about being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another thing that as Americans we don't like. We don't want to be uncomfortable. Right. But mm-hmm. from listening to these conversations and to many conversations, that's actually an essential piece of connecting with people that are different from you. And one of the people who talks about that so beautifully is in your interview with Kwame Anthony Appiah.
Yes.
I heard it this spring and I was glued to the radio because he talked about how difference has played a part in his life, partly because pretty much wherever he goes, he is different, mm-hmm. but also how he believes the way that we get through that is by knowing not just about Muslims, but about Layla and Ahmed, that we bring people who are different into our lives.
Yes. I mean, and so here's this great erudite philosopher who has studied in societies across time how profound moral change happens, how from one generation to the next, people could ask themselves, and the examples would be foot binding in China, slavery as a fundamental part of trade in the British Empire. People will ask themselves from one generation to the next, how did we live that way? We thought that was honorable, you know, not just normal, but honorable. His parents' marriage, which was an interracial marriage in the 1960s, and helped inspire the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So he actually, his family lived through that, where his parents' marriage was a scandalous, scandalous thing. And then 10 years later, you know, it's like when I tell my children that when I was born in the 1960s, black people were sitting in the backs of buses in the South, in this country. They can't imagine that. So for him, to him, I posed the question, think of this utter breakdown of political and civic dialogue in our country right now as a kind of moral crisis that it's hard to imagine beyond. And what's interesting, because he's such an intellectual, but what's interesting is that his advice is some of the most down-to-earth advice that you can hear, right? He says, don't start by trying to resolve what you disagree with on gay marriage or the budget. Start by getting to know people. He talks about conversation in the old-fashioned sense of the word, which is habits of association, coming to see each other as human beings, even if you disagree, and that changes how you're going to interact with each other.
And he tells this wonderful story about one of his own earliest experiences with that, which is with his grandmother's neighbor, that his grandmother
yes.
had this big, wonderful house, and eventually she sold it to a member of parliament and moved into the little carriage house next door. And that set in motion a chance for him to meet someone very different. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, it's great that you mentioned that because a listener so responded to that. It's a mundane story about life. I mean, he had grown up in this very liberal family and he was a young man. And so he was even more extreme and convinced in his views than you sometimes get when you nuance them with age. And there was this elderly neighbor who was absolutely on the other side, the opposite side of the political spectrum to him. But they talked to each other. and they got to know each other. And what was transformative about that was not that this gentleman talked Kwame Anthony Appiah out of anything he believed, or that he talked him out of anything he believed, but it was that a rapport was possible. It was that humanizing moment. And we had so many listeners who wrote in who had their own story. And, you know, part of what happens in a moment like that is just to recognize these human encounters as having the power they do. You know, that's a piece of power that we have to take those kinds of things seriously, to find ways to make those kinds of encounters more possible for ourselves and our children. That, in fact, is something very practical that we can do, even while inside the Beltway, it's a mess. Right.
And even outside, you know, I was thinking when I listened to that conversation, I wish I had a toolkit about how to have those kinds of conversations, how to even begin them, because many of us live in places where we don't encounter people who have very different points of view.
Right. And, you know, another piece of that he brought up and that other people have brought up is the role of technology. I mean, again, it's kind of becoming conscious of these things. There's so many fabulous things about technology, like the fact that you and I can have this conversation halfway across the country. One of the things that technology has done is it has diminished what we used to call the public square. It's made possible a million private squares where you associate with people who are like you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the kind of weird segregation along socioeconomic and I suppose also political lines that happens in American neighborhoods as well. So there's something in this moment that does challenge all of us, I think, to step outside those zones. I have to challenge myself on this, right? Where when we hear the news about people who are on another side of the, you know, this issue or that issue or the political divide than us, we've never met any of those people, right? And that's wrong. We have to create civic life. But one of the relief with for example, Anthony Appiah is he says, don't talk about that subject you disagree on. Talk about baseball. Talk about the weather. Talk about mundane things. Talk about your children. Get to know each other as human beings. And on that basis, then eventually you can talk about this stuff. And you can disagree, but you can find ways to keep living together and do that respectfully.
In the show and on your website, do you offer suggestions of how people might be able to introduce this into their own lives?
Well, we're kind of, you know, I think in every different conversation, I've got the poet Elizabeth Alexander, who actually talks about words as tools, really important and refreshing. Anthony Appiah has this real down-to-earth advice about human relationship. Sherry Turkle is at MIT's initiative on technology and self, and she talks about shaping technology to human purposes, that we have that power if we grasp it in our families, in our communities. So every different voice comes from a different part of our culture, and they all offer questions, I think, that are useful in and of themselves. And they all offer what I think of as, you know, not just ideas, but tools. And so we're really inviting people to take these conversations on that way, start new conversations in their communities and tell us what happens. And I'm excited about where we might then be able to take this out of the series.
I'm speaking with Krista Tippett, who is the host of On Being, about her 6-part series, Civil Conversations, which starts this weekend on WNYC. You can hear On Being on Saturdays at 3 p.m. on AM 820 and on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. on 93.9 FM. And we're going to be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein here for Leonard Lopate on this Monday afternoon, and I'm speaking with Krista Tippett, who is the host of On Being. And we're talking about a series that's going to begin this weekend called Civil Conversations. Krista, you often talk with theologians and with people who are involved in the political process. I was very happy to see that you chose a poet for one of these conversations, too.
Yes, yes.
And the poet is Elizabeth Alexander, and we have a poem that we pulled from your website. In fact, I'd love to hear that first before we start talking about her. So let's listen to this. This is Elizabeth Alexander reading one of her poems.
On suffering, which is real. On the mouth that never closes, the air that dries the mouth. On the miraculous dying body, its greens and purples. On the beauty of hair itself. On the dazzling toddler, like eggplant, he says, when you say vegetable, chrysanthemum to flower. On his grandmother's suffering, larger than vanished skyscrapers, September zucchini, other things too big, for her glory that goes along with it. Glory of grown children's vigil, communal fealty, glory of the body that operates even as it falls apart. The body that can no longer even make fever, but nonetheless burns, florid and bright and magnificent, as it dims, as it shrinks, as it turns to something else.
That's the poem Autumn Passage, and it's by the poet Elizabeth Alexander. She's one of the guests Krista Tippett speaks to in this series called Civil Conversations. Krista, I read that poem and listened to it, and in a moment she takes us from that dazzling toddler to that brightly burning grandmother.
And that was her mother-in-law. It was about her, the death of her mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, can art open up these kinds of conversations in ways that other sets of questions can't?
See, I absolutely think so. And Elizabeth Alexander was so wonderful on that. I observe in my work, we actually have a lot of poetry on the show, more and more, because when we put it on the air, people are drawn to it, right? It's like we're starved for poetry, like it's something we need as human beings, but we've forgotten that.
Or that it calls to us in a way that nothing else does, a call to attention.
Right. And so that the poem you just read is a wonderful example of I could tell you a story. I could tell you the facts of the death of her mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. Right. I could give you a factual account.
Or of that toddler who knows
or of the
eggplant
toddler.
For vegetable.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Or we could also even tell it as a story and it would be something different. What poetry gets at with great precision and brevity, as she talks about, is undergirding truths, right? And I think that can be especially actually relevant in our public life now when the notion of truth and fact itself is something that we're up against, right? Mm-hmm. But we don't know anymore. How do we talk about undergirding truths? How do we subvert that completely fraught discussion of for and against and talk about what really matters?
There's also something about it, too, that is able to move a listener not to anger or fury, but to understanding and kind of empathy with the person being discussed.
Exactly. Right. A softer place in ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another line, one of her poems that she also reads ends with this line, poetry here is the human voice, and are we not of interest to each other? So just that line, I mean, if rather than saying, can't we agree, or where do you stand on this issue, or let's have a debate, I think putting a question like that, are we not of interest to each other? Out there into our public spaces and just letting ourselves dwell on that question and seeing what kinds of responses might emerge from that is really valuable.
Well, we are speaking right now to a wonderful WNYC public radio audience, and Maud in Park Slope just left a comment on our show page that echoes what you've just said, which is, I heard a show on Memorial Day where a guest suggested talking to a veteran and just listening to whatever they wanted to talk about. I hadn't even considered that just being listened to might be helpful to a veteran.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I never did anything about this, I guess mostly because it's scary to talk to someone who is so different from you. And on top of that, to talk about something so emotional like what they went through. But I think, and I hear it in your show, it's not so much what people say, but that you are listening to them. And we are, too.
Yes. And Julie, you know, what's so interesting is this is being borne out by science, right? This cutting-edge science of the brain tells us that actually being listened to has physiological effect. There's research that shows that even in very heated, difficult debates, if at the end of that, when some decision is taken, if people who lose the argument feel that they've been heard, they are better able to make peace with what the result is.
And I think about this borne out every single day, and I'll want to get to your guest, Sherry Turkle, in a minute, but I think about my computer at my house. One of them is in the kitchen, and often I'm working when my kids are home, and my 13-year-old will come up to me and grab my face and make me look at him and listen to him. And, hearing what you're saying makes me realize it's so essential, and there's so much distraction now from just that act of listening.
Yes.
And it's so essential in our interactions, even every day with our kids.
It's essential. It's redemptive. You know, that's not a word we use in public a lot, but we need redemptive encounters and redemptive language. I don't have to say that in a religious way, right? Mm-hmm. I think that can be a civic aspiration.
When you had Sherry Turkle on the show, she focuses on technology. And one of the things that struck me was her own story about when she was a little girl and what she believes may have driven her to focus on this aspect of our lives. Can you tell us that story?
The looking that she didn't know her father.
Yes,
right?
the looking for her
objects,
father.
Mm-hmm. Right? Looking for clues.
And finding becoming a photograph where his face had been rubbed out.
Yes, but kind of being a bit of a detective and seeing how important objects are. And then in our world for the last couple decades, that's led her to think about, you know, these digital objects of our lives and how they are not just changing the way we interact, you know, the structure of society and business, but the nature of human relationship. And what's so wonderful about her, I think, is that, and she's at MIT, right? She's right at the center of this, in this great technological place. But she says, I think a lot of us feel like technology is advancing so quickly you can't keep up. It's the best you can do to keep up, much less could you stop and think about how is this changing us or how do we want to limit it or how do we want to organize it. And she says that is our responsibility and absolutely something that's within our grasp. We simply have to stop and shape technology to human purposes, shape technology to honor what we hold dear. It's possible. It's a matter of choice. It's interesting because we didn't originally consider that show to be a civil conversations program.
Mm-hmm.
But as we neared the end of creating it, we realized that technology is right there in the middle in so many ways of how we are able to relate to each other or not relate to each other. And this question of how we get a handle on that is absolutely going to shape the world we move into in every way, relationally, politically, socially.
Now, when you chose these programs, what was your criteria for what is a civil conversation?
Oh, I really think in the end it was us sitting down and saying, knowing the effect that these particular six programs had had on us and on listeners, and a sense that putting them together one after the other, because they aired over a period of 9 months, and we put them in a slightly different order than they aired before, that we wanted to hear them again, mm-hmm. and to hear them together and to hear that cumulative effect of these ideas and tools for, this is one way we've thought about this, is, you know, ideas and tools for healing our fractured civic spaces. And what, you know, I want to stress this again, that we as citizens can and must begin that work right now, right? If we say, well, let's wait for media to change, or let's wait for the political system to fix itself, or whoever we will elect in the next season, there's work to be done right now. And civic spaces are everywhere. And our families are civic spaces, right? The mm-hmm. interesting thing about some of these moral values debates is that it's the Thanksgiving dinner table that suffers as much as the halls of Congress. So how do we begin now where we live, in our families, our communities, our neighborhoods, our religious institutions, to reframe the conversation?
One of the frictions that comes up, too, as you hear these things one against the next, that I heard was between Kwame Anthony Appiah. Not that they would disagree with each other in a forceful way, but he talks about he's gay and how difficult it is sometimes for him when people are very homophobic, and that he believes that gay marriage should be allowed. And indeed, here in New York State, it is allowed now. And
yes,
then
yes.
You've had a conversation on your website after the interview with, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Richard...
Right. That's one of the shows with Richard Mao.
Yes. Who questions that. And one of your listeners wrote in saying, I'm heartbroken that you've put this on the air.
Right. And so that, I think, is important. We have two programs of people who are inside some of these really hot button issues. Francis Kissling, who was a longtime president of Catholics for Choice, and Richard Mao, who's an evangelical educator. He's president of a really globally important Fuller Seminary, evangelical educational institution. He doesn't believe that the Bible or theology sanctions same-sex marriage, but there's a great integrity to him in the way he has understood that, let me put it this way, that the measure of his Christianity ultimately is not the positions he takes, but how he treats people. And so holding that position, he has also stayed in relationship and in conversation across the years. In fact, when I told him that we're putting his show together with Anthony Appiah, he said, oh, great, I use his books in my course.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was an exchange that's also on the website because there were some people who were disturbed about, and this was when we put that program on the air originally, it was right after Tyler Clementi had committed suicide,
oh,
right? And
dear.
There is a question out there about, does this kind of proclamation about the legitimacy of love between two people of the same gender, does however civilly stated, does that kind of proclamation still feed into violence and hatred and tragedy like this, right? So that's a question that's out there. There were people who responded to hearing Richard Mao that way. There were also people who sent us stories, like a woman who said, my son is gay. I don't believe in it. I don't think it's right. But after I heard this conversation with Richard Mao, for the first time, I was able to talk to my son again and to be with him. And we actually had an exchange with a gay listener who had been disturbed by Mao and who heard that story and said, okay, I see the value. You know, I see that there can be value in this voice out there, even if it is really uncomfortable for me. There's mystery, and there's a sense in which we have to be willing to hold some of this stuff just in tension and let ourselves be uncomfortable as we find ways to talk about it that feel like we can all be in the room talking and be honored.
The way that Parker Palmer talks about standing in the tragic gap, that we have to hold that tension until we understand where we need to move, but that we can't move without holding that tension.
And, you know, there's so much fear behind especially some of these intimate issues of sexuality. Richard Mao, one thing he talks about a lot in his circles, where, you know, he says people listen to Glenn Beck a lot. He says he talks to people about the temptation that fear brings to not be able to see the truth about people we begin to perceive as enemies. And that's a really, he's wise on that, and I think that's a really, really, Frances Kissling is wise on that too. She's been inside the abortion debate on the pro-choice side for years, but she spent the last few years not getting nearly so much attention, coming into a new kind of relationship with her political opposites. It's not about changing her mind or changing their mind, but she thinks that the only way we will move forward on some of these debates, move forward in ways that we can't envision now, whatever moving forward looks like, is to really start over, really reframe the way we approach each other.
And what does she suggest on that particular issue? How is she doing that for herself?
Well, she's come to some questions that I think questions can be great tools. Right? That's the other thing in our civic life. We're so focused on having the answer and winning the debate. And I think we need to get better at listening, as we said, but listening and also letting raising better questions, right? So I think some of the practical tools that Frances Kissling offers are in the form of tools that it took her years to be able to ask. But, right, she says to start to have a different kind of dialogue, you have to be able to name what makes you uncomfortable in your own position, or at least where you have questions. And you have to be able to see what is good in the position of the other, mm-hmm. whether you agree with it or not. And that when both sides can come together with that kind of, really it's a vulnerability, mm-hmm. then good things happen. She says, though, counterintuitively, the pressure of coming to agreement, she says, I'm not a big believer in common ground. That pressure of coming to agreement works against understanding each other. That's a theme that's recurred throughout these interviews. But that something more important and probably ultimately more fruitful can happen when you stop trying to come to agreement and you start trying to understand each other.
Through these interviews, what surprised you the most as you listen back to them? Are there themes, as you said, are there ideas that run through them that you thought, I didn't hear this the first time?
That's a good question. Julie, like you, I spend my life framing good questions and wanting to ask better questions, but the value of questions themselves as practical tools was a wonderful gift. Mm-hmm. I also have to say, there's a lot of hope in these conversations. We are just so bombarded with everything that's going wrong, and it's overwhelming. I mean, somebody we haven't mentioned is Vincent Harding, who's mm-hmm. in the series, who's a civil rights veteran. And I wanted to have him on the show because I thought there was a time, the 1960s, where you had these existential civilizational debates. You know, it was a moment of great turmoil, of incredible public violence, right? Assassinations, mm-hmm. But also of great social change. So I wanted to know right now, as we're in another moment, which has those same features, are there lessons from that time that we might be learning? Vincent Harding has been out there for all these years. He wrote speeches for Martin Luther King Jr. He's been taking those lessons of civil rights to kids all over the country, and he talks about places like Detroit, which everybody's willing to write off. As he says, those are the incubators. He says that's where your next generation is going to come from. I think something very important that's simple and not simple is deciding what we're going to look at and see, training our eyes, training our ears, saying, being realistic, but saying yes and. Yes, mm-hmm. this is going terribly wrong, and this too is possible. And kind of taking it upon ourselves to create those possibilities. And I have to say, with all of these conversations, with Sherry Turkle on technology, with Anthony Appiah on great moral change, with Elizabeth Alexander thinking about just using language differently in a way that can be transformative, I see that can be immediately possible. And that is a bit of a surprise to be able to say it that way.
And that's wonderful. And it's wonderful to end our conversation on a note of hope and possibility.
Yeah.
I have been speaking with Krista Tippett, who is the host of On Being, about her 6-part series, Civil Conversations, which starts this weekend on WNYC. You can hear On Being on Saturdays at 3 p.m. on AM 820 and on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 10 p.m. on 93.9 FM. Krista, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a great conversation. Thanks, Julie.